You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke up, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Switch your pike upon your...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, September 13th, 2018. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
Blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Before we get going with today's show, I need to warn you all about something. This episode will be short, and it will come across rushed. That's my fault. I and the local comrades are trying a few new things up here, and it's a learning curve for everybody. We will keep doing better, I promise. Today I promised you all a Q&A episode. Now there are a couple of items I just won't have time to get to, and they probably deserve their own show entirely. So with that, let's begin. Right off the bat, we were sent this question over the contact. Someone's interested, but they have a half-Asian girlfriend. Is that all right? Yeah, this one's serious, just like almost every other time we're asked a similar question. And obviously the answer is no. Why are you even interested in white nationalism if you're seeing a woman of mixed race? Look, character matters. And clearly, you think anti-white dating habits are all right when you do them, or else you would have stopped. If you have political beliefs, dictating that contributing to the birth of such a woman is morally wrong, then why are you involved with her at all? Again, character. This is a great example of that white character problem the Northwest Front refuses to shut up about. It's all well and good to have some theoretic ideals, but applying them consistently is what counts. Now, more on that when I get to the question about Dr. Jordan Peterson. Someone asked if I, personally, was going to write more Northwest independence novels. No, why would I? I'm not a writer. And Harold himself indicated that the mythos was what he thought it should be, and that it was time to stop doing that sort of thing and actually make the NAR a reality. Just a reminder, the white world is being extinguished, and we need a white homeland, not more books about a white homeland. Someone over Gab asked me for a general timeline of what the party is up. Well, we've never actually given a timeline for anything, and I don't know that that would change now. Even so, I have talked about a theoretical 2-month period we expected all this to be wrapped up in. That 2-month period technically started on August 1st, and while I can't give you the details about why it's that way, I can confirm that things are on track with a major twist. There's a whole lot more to do, and we didn't know about that until we found out certain things in dealing with Harold's affairs, so the actual date of our transition period is up in the air. And I would tell you more, but, well, it's nobody's business but ours. I'm sorry for the lack of details, and I am sorry I can't be more concrete about when normal party activity will resume, but it is what it is. I can only emphasize that the things we're doing right now are largely up to circumstances out of our control. Now bear this in mind, I more or less inherited Harold's role, and he actually gave himself a title at one point, and that title was General Secretary. My job is to keep the party operational until I and the other comrades here in the homeland are in a position to begin the legal activity associated with the Butler Plan. All sorts of people, with a noted uptick in frequency following Harold's death, have gotten a hold of the party and asked whether or not we can give them something, whether that be food, money, housing, employment, and even legal assistance with immigration. And no, really, this isn't just one or two people, this is actually an awful lot, and it does happen all the time. Look, we understand why you're asking, but the answer is, again, no. The party has always been very upfront about the fact that we don't actually have a whole lot to help you with right now. More importantly, there are all sorts of genuine and well-intentioned requests from foreigners who want to come to the U.S. to come to the Northwest to help us out, who are asking for immigration-related references or things like that. And yes, we get a ton of those requests, but we can't actually do that for reasons that ought to be obvious, and I don't want to spend time discussing them here. Now, when we turn you down for something like this, whether it be three hots and a cot, or legal paperwork that we can't legally fill out, or anything like that, please don't respond by throwing a temper tantrum. In almost every case when someone asks, and it's been this way for years, people blow up at us as a response. Now, I want you to think about one thing. Remember, your online behavior is almost certainly your first point of contact with the party, and if you blow it, that's hard to come back from. And remember, entitlement is bad, okay? Now, during one of these temper tantrums, I was asked whether or not the party assumes that everybody is either upper middle class or even wealthy, such that they can just move without any assistance. Okay, spaced repetition time. Would it surprise you to learn that there are more modes of economic being than pauper and 1%? I mean, I certainly wasn't either of those things when I came home, and most others weren't either. Truth be told, my migration experience is what the party would like to label average, all things considered. Yeah, I looked for work before moving, lined up work, lined up a place to live, and then moved. And I did it all in about a year. Other people that I've met here in the homeland have a far more interesting and impressive story that actually puts mine to shame. Now, I'm not going to give a whole lot of details, but there's a family that lives in Portland, and they've been here longer than I have. I don't want to give too many details about their identities, but they came here more or less in their car and had to set up shop. The father of this family, as well as the mother, had marketable skills. Not too long after that, they were doing very well for themselves. They actually owned a home that was a very nice place to be, and I know that because they were very gracious enough to host party dinners there for a whole lot of people. I consider it a pleasure to have met them and an honor that they were willing to have me over, and I sincerely regret that my schedule hasn't allowed me to see more of them than it has. You need to be like them, not like the people who whine that we can't put them up or sign legal papers on their behalf or give them something that they should be providing themselves. Remember, character. You need to do what we've done. You need to put it on the line like we put it on the line and come here and then tell us what we did wrong, not the other way around. And since that character thing is coming up so frequently today, I was also asked by RFN Comment what I think of Jordan Peterson and his approach to the character issue. Well, I don't necessarily agree that he is fixing the character issue. Remember, we as white nationalists are supposed to have a higher standard of what that actually entails, and there's a massive flaw in his approach. I'm sure you all remember that Jordan Peterson was very popular in the alt-right prior to its disintegration, and you'll note that inconsistencies, character problems, and issues with standards pretty much define the alt-right as well. So this is actually a great segue into understanding whether or not someone a real white nationalist, like RFN keeps telling you to learn to discern for yourselves. Now, firstly, no, Jordan Peterson is not a white nationalist. He is quite plain that he's not a white nationalist, and he even brags that his work keeps people from becoming white nationalists. You should be very, very suspicious of him for that alone, and I'll explain why. Shortly after Radio Free Northwest eulogized Harold, I gave a talk about my own character development and my own homecoming experience in the year following my discovery of the Butler, and I pointed out the ways in which I found out I had been wrong, and I had been and have been and continue to be very blessed in my life to get to learn the things I learn and have the opportunity to apply them. Being taught good morals and nice ideas and really good-sounding stuff that makes liberals look stupid is actually pretty trivial. And most of Jordan Peterson's advice is that a good father would give his children in a very paleocon and sometimes even vaguely neocon sort of way a few decades ago. It's actually very basic, and we would look at it as kind of a given. So again, don't be too impressed with it. Recall my experience. White nationalism and the Butler Plan specifically showed me a glaring blind spot I had in which I was not consistently applying the same types of moral standards that I used in the rest of my life to make the rest of my decisions. I knew right then I had to change that, and as with so many other examples of the character problem that RFN brings up, consistent application of your beliefs is the key to living out the solution to the character problem. but more on that in later shows. What you have to understand about Jordan Peterson's bragging that he's not a white nationalist and bragging that people tell him his material keeps them from joining us in our politics is that, like anything else, it's a deliberate misapplication and deliberate inconsistent handling of very important issues. That's not fixing the character problem. True, it might put someone on a path to coming here, but at the same time, it's well acknowledged by virtually everyone in the white nationalist world that Jordan Peterson is a gatekeeper to us, and because of that, I refuse to put much stock in him at all.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to be discussing A Child of Christian Blood by Edmund Levine. This book is one of the last four sent by Harold. This trial drama tells the true story of Mendel Belus. Belus was a moderately religious Jew who had moved to Kiev to find factory work. As a moderate Jew, Belus was an unlikely candidate for the charge of Jewish ritual murder. Even persons who were right-wing, such as Stefan Zakharchenko, who was a member of the Black Hundred, which was considered to be a highly anti-Semitic group, believed Mendel innocent. Even so, the author writes about how Belus would come to be a scapegoat by various officials who wished to please the traditionalist Tsar Nicholas, who was himself a believer in the blood libel mythos. Actually, the notion of blood libel, while well established in Russia by this time, had come from the Roman Catholic tradition to the West, and also smaller groups such as the Eastern Rite Catholics and also the Unitates. Such murders, it is said, are more likely to occur in spring, as blood might be used in the Purim Hamantasin, which is a Purim treat, although blood powder might also be involved in the production of matzah, it was said. The corpse would be found, but there would be no obvious motive for such a terrible murder. These corpses would be unburied and uncovered, and they would be found to have stab wounds in multiples of seven. These Jews are not merely dark gourmands. They are said to need Christian blood to cure a disease and to save themselves from sin. And indeed, if salvation from sin is the concern, another time, potentially to watch out for these ritual murders, I would suspect would be during the early fall when Jews have Days of Atonement. So that might be potentially another time to watch out for this. In any case, as was stated in this book several times, the question for the jury in this case was not so much the question of blood libel per se, but the guilt or innocence of Belus, who after all had really been languishing in prison for about 3 years, and the prison conditions in Russia at that time were really very poor. Tsar Alexei had barred accusations of murder based solely on the belief that Jews Christian blood. Even so, he would still order an investigation that would take place in Belarus in 1823. But apparently this investigation didn't get very far because in 1835 Nicholas would end this investigation. However, Nicholas would not endorse Alexei's 1817 decree against the accusation of ritual murder based solely on the theory of blood libel. Some of this information about the blood libel was taken from monks who had been born a Jewish but had converted to Christianity by the age of 12. The author is also very concerned about the mother of the victim. Her name was Vera Chiburyak. She was the mother of the victim, Andrei Yaschinsky. Vera was very much involved in certain crime rings. She was also known for covering up possibly information about this case. During the investigation, her surviving son was dying of dysentery, and it was apparent that he wanted to make a deathbed confession. However, when he tried to do this, Vera put her mouth over his and apparently kissing him, depriving him of this deathbed confession. This was very obvious because this happened in front of the investigators. Also, she was connected to an old Jew by the name of Tartakovsky, who was very suspicious because he took something of an interest in the boy and case when the boy was found murdered. This investigation was very drawn out, but by September the 25th, 1913, the trial started. The case would take 3 months, and the international community in Western Europe in America would rally around Billis. Not all of them were Jewish. Indeed, there were even some that didn't care for Jews, but really thought this particular Jew was being very much railroaded for this and used more as a symbol than anything else. He had a Jewish attorneys by the name of Margolin and Rosenberg, who ended up getting him off. The United States government at the time thought that he was innocent, did not want to alienate Russia because at the time there was a concern that a hostile regime had recently taken over in Mexico. Billis, although declared innocent, was really unable to stay in the Kiev area, and he would end up moving to Palestine. The Russian regime would collapse in 1917. Before Nicholas was himself murdered, he intended to give over the kingdom essentially to his brother Kale, but never, as we know, got a chance to do that. He did, of course, as we all know, Nicholas did have a son, but the son was not only relatively young, but he was also, as we know, a hemophiliac. So they thought him too sickly to take the throne. Today, the grave of Andrei Yastchinsky is very well tended. It is presumably tended by our right-wingers who see him as a symbol. Of course, someone who genuinely believes in blood libel is unlikely to be overly convinced by a book that was itself written by a Jew author. And of course, as we know, Harold was a very strong proponent of this belief in a Jewish ritual murder. And I do have to say that this book was something of a page turner, even for me. That's saying quite a lot because I don't always like scandalous cases. You know, these stories of ritual murder, I think, are a bit much, even for people that don't much care for Jews. There's probably a lot of people that would find these stories rather extreme, perhaps rather ridiculous. But at any rate, I am doing this tribute, as I said before, of the last 4 books that Harold sent me. So once again, the name of this book is A Child of Christian Blood by Edmund Levine. I hope you found this discussion to be as fascinating as I did. This is very much a look into the history of the late Russian Empire. So I found it very much capturing the flavor of Russia, or at least what I would imagine the flavor of Russia to be. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
City Hall, oh, Rudolph S., your mega. an attempt out at unity so the brothers war would cease. Held as a private prisoner for the duration of the war until October 1945 when the trial hit the floor. Hess was found guilty for crimes against peace, sentenced to a life in hell for fighting for his beliefs. For the next 40 years he rotted in his penal cell, cause he tried to end the war, they sentenced him to hell.
Comrades, this is the trucker coming at you from Wisconsin. Just made a lap through the homeland, had a load coming up from California, delivered in Kent, Washington, and reloaded up in Anacortes, and now headed for Ohio. The weather was a little smoky in southern Oregon. It was clearing up around the Portland, Eugene, Seattle area. The visibility was picking up. Didn't smell smoke, but it was still a little bit on the hazy side. But other than that, it was fairly nice weather. Didn't manage to make it past the homestead because of where I was delivering and what I was carrying. I didn't feel comfortable leaving the trailer by itself. Yeah, it kind of gets that way when you're carrying sensitive temperature-controlled loads. For those of you that are planning on coming up here to the homeland RVing it, most, not necessarily all, but most of the Washington rest areas have RV dumps where you can go and empty your tanks. Up there in the Kent industrial area where I was delivering, I saw at least one motorhome parked. There was few houses in the area, but it's still kind of an industrial park area. And as long as you're not trashing the side of the street, they don't mind you parking in those areas. You'll have to check it out if you come up here doing it that way, because some of the areas are posted no trucks or no RVs or have parking hour limitations on them, but not in the area that I was in. The only freebie truck stop that I know of up there that I would consider putting an RV into, but not on the truck side, would be the Love's there in Tacoma. I don't really even like going in there with my big truck, but sometimes I have to go in there to scale it out to check my weights. That's not a very friendly place for trucks, but it's not too bad on the car side. They have some bobtail parking for trucks you could probably stuff an RV into. Not necessarily pickup truck and trailer, but a small motorhome. You'd probably go and park in those areas. There's a couple of car spots you could probably get a tow vehicle and trailer into, but I wouldn't go and stay there for days on end necessarily. Wheel in there, maybe park overnight, get what you need, and mosey on. They do have numerous campgrounds up there in that area. Not sure how full they are, the availability of spots, but there are RV parks up there that you can go and park in. Not sure of the cost either. You'd have to check it out. I don't know if anybody's actually going to be doing it other than that one comrade that put his piece in there on the podcast about a month ago. But I just thought I'd throw that in there for those of you that might be thinking about doing your housing that way. Once you get up here, check the areas out and see. Hope to see you out here on the road making your scouting trips and your migration soon. This is the Trucker signing off from near Madison, Wisconsin on my way to Ohio.
They say, can you go? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
Now, I know the bull sessions Harold, myself, and some others have been very popular on RFN, but unfortunately this is going to stop being a fun little Q&A bull session, even though it's still going to be Q&A. I'm moving on to questions about why we don't care about things other than the Butler Plan, and more specifically, why we don't support other homeland pseudo-movements and things like that. This is, regrettably, going to be controversial in white nationalism, but we've never shied away from that. Just fair warning. So some weeks ago, it was observed in RFN comments that it doesn't seem like we care to consider anything outside the Northwest Independence novels. Why not? Okay, that's actually a fair question, and I'll get into that when I cover some other things in later shows that I really can't do justice with in today's format. But I have to point out this is a non-criticism because there's no actual content. Really, it's just a gripe. It's coming from someone that for one reason or another doesn't want to do the Butler Plan, whether it's the Butler Plan itself, or it's the Northwest, or they don't like one or more of the personalities involved, or something. Again, I don't know, because it's non-content. Even so, what other plan would we consider? I'm not aware that there is one. I'm aware that there are other pseudo-homeland efforts, or non-efforts, but again, I'll get there in a moment. There's also the option of electoral politics. And, well, okay, look, I keep teasing this talk about Trump's election from my perspective, and it's actually going to be a series of talks, and I don't have time to go there today, but I want to point out that I can at least understand this coming from a new white nationalist as opposed to someone who's been with us for a very long time. To be completely accurate, and I believe this is objective as well, prior to the advent of the Trumpmeister, the Northwest Imperative was it. It's all the movement had, and it had been acknowledged that way pretty much universally for quite some time. Truth be told, because electoral politics aren't a thing, as far as we're concerned, we just don't care. Now, it's true that there are other white nationalist outfits that claim they want to do other things, but that claim bears a little bit of examination, because, first point, most of them don't actually have any sort of a plan whatsoever, whereas we have a plan that has been proven historically to be effective for what we need. That should be all you need to know, but even so, there are other people doing pseudo-homeland efforts, and I keep saying pseudo-homeland efforts because I don't think they're quite on par with us, and this is going to become unpleasant in a little bit, so I'm trying to lead into that gently. In the recent past, someone reminded me that, theoretically speaking, it is possible to have a 100% peaceful Balkanization, but the possibility is so remote that it isn't worth discussing. The reason we don't consider anything outside of the Northwest Independence novels is that the white race needs the NAR specifically rather than something else that has no actual possibility of working out in the foreseeable future. Now, that foreseeable future may include events that aren't quite how the Northwest Independence novels have things play out. That said, I believe the novels are still the most likely scenario, and I say that simply because the underlying relevant details of the theoretic novel situation and where we find ourselves right now are still largely the same. But I'll get to that in a sec. So that immediately leads me into another question I was recently asked, which is, what homeland movements do I support, other than the NAR? Now, I have to be careful answering this, since I'm friendly with the guy asking, and I'd like to leave it that way. Even so, I have to be honest first and foremost, because, Well, we're playing for keeps this time as a race. The answer, obviously, is none. The simple reason for that is this. Truly bringing a new nation out of occupied territory into being is going to take everything the white race on this continent has, and this nonsense about so-called supporting everyone who tries to pull off an NF copycat outfit is what's going to end our race. I chose my words there very carefully, because the guy asking the question indicated that he supports all sorts of other homeland movements. With all due respect, dude, you and I are good friends, but I have to call shenanigans. And I have to call shenanigans because what does this support even mean in the real world? Let's think back to the panel discussion some months ago between Harold and several others about their takes on the homeland movement. I made it a point not to share my reaction because I was laughing so hard I fell out of my chair a few times. At some point, I'm actually going to have to replay snippets of that and comment, but now's not the time. A short version. Look at it this way. One of the comments on the party's website in response to that audio being uploaded was a celebration of the unity of thought presented in that talk, even though everybody there was advocating different things. Somehow, we're still stuck in theorycraft mode where, oh look, we all agree on things that are perfectly obvious. You know, that's what causes so much trouble in white nationalism, particularly among new white nationalists, is that there's this perception that because every white nationalist acknowledges some really basic, and yeah, fundamental and important, but they're still basic and pretty obvious things, that they must agree on everything, or there must be some unity that should be maintained. I have to point out the obvious here, and that's that you cannot obey the Northwest imperative as well as the whatever else imperative at the same time. So again, what is this support? How am I going to support or even agree with other homeland efforts? The instant I tell somebody that, oh yeah, that's okay, I'm telling them that the one viable plan to end white genocide, the Butler plan, can be skipped out on, and I can't do that. The support for contradictory efforts can only exist in theory, and that's the sort of support we don't care about. I'm sorry, look, please don't shoot the messenger. In fact, I want it made plain that I have a very, very biting analogy that would be incredibly offensive, and I'm deliberately not employing it because I'm trying to gloss over this conflict in favor of getting people to think for themselves in such a way that they actually act on it. Because again, the only way you can support more than one of these is if you intend to act on none of them, and that defeats the point of, quite frankly, any of, oddly enough. Okay, so I can't say all that and then just not discuss why I think it's the Northwest imperative or bust. So I'm going to do that since it's still relevant to the previous two questions. I want to point out this is largely a critique of everything else out, and for so many years, everything else out there didn't even bother to have a plan. And I still assert that there are no actual plans compared to what the Northwest imperative has going on in terms of the Butler plan. If I'm wrong about that, could somebody please show me specifics, because I would be interested to address them. I don't have time to enumerate the other proposals in detail, but I will hit some highlights. Those highlights particularly will be about the Northwest imperative versus the lack of anything anywhere else. And the most important of those highlights is reality. Firstly, the Butler plan, as explained in the Northwest Independence novels, is an actual plan that relies on historically validated methods of liberating colonial territory in situations possessing direct parallels to our time and place. Can the other homeland efforts say that? I don't believe so. And the very same reality dictating that also dictates two other very important things we must observe. Other so-called plans rely on collapse scenarios, and the right wing loves to talk about collapse scenarios, but has yet to actually see a collapse scenario even materialize on the horizon. Why do we assume that there's going to be a collapse that lifts the federal monkey off of our back? The first of these very real points is that the United States government is almost certain to continue existing after the white race is dead, at least for a little bit. So we can't rely on some fantastical scenario where the federal monkey is magically lifted off our back and we all do the necessary with all the non-whites around us. And those non-whites are the second of these reality-defined situations that we have to deal with. These same non-plans simply indicate all the non-whites will die off or kill each other, or there will be some sort of magical system politics event that allows us to just deport them all. We all know it's not going to work that way, so could we please come back to reality and actually deal with the situation we're in? For example, someone recently told me that another of these homeland efforts Phillips thinks they're going to get coast access, which is part of why the Pacific Northwest is so important, but this other plan is going to get coast access through North Texas. Now, I'm a native Texan, and I'm actually all over that state every so often for family reasons. I've forgotten more about Texas than most people have ever learned. What are you going to do with the population there such that they would allow a white ethnostate access to their coastline from the interior United States? Come on. So the situation we're dealing with is we have to confront the federal government to force them to give up colonial territory that we're trying to liberate, and we have to be able to do something about the hordes of non-whites. Now, once the federal monkey, as we keep referring to it, is lifted off our backs, we no longer have all of those stupid civil rights statutes that we're subject to, we can do what we need to, and odds are the non-whites would just mostly leave throughout the process of liberating that territory anyway. We'll see when it happens. Those are the two situations that no one actually wants to address in their homeland efforts, and the Butler Plan has that all dealt with already. Plus, we know this sort of thing actually works when it's tried, because we have many historical examples of people, white people usually, doing this and pulling it off. And lastly, there really is the issue of the Zogland being willing to lose territory. Where would they do that? Someone else recently asked me a question about New England and whether or not New England was the idyllic ethnostate. Well, that's the Zogland's base of power. They're not going to give that to us. The Pacific Northwest, on the other hand, is practically a hinterland and a backwater as far as the rest of the country is concerned. If we're going to deal seriously with the reality that we have to negotiate this away from the federal government after they're forced to admit they can't hold on to it for financial reasons, where would that territory be? The answer is, the answer to every question that we're asking today is the Pacific Northwest. And again, earlier RFM material, particularly the first year, covers all of this in great detail. If you're trying to make your mind up about this, go listen to the first year of RFN and you'll know what's up. Some of you will probably detect the frustration in my voice. And to be honest, this was all decided quite some time ago before the NF copycats came around and decided to pick a homeland convenient to their current zip. That's not good enough. And to be perfectly blunt, I went through this process myself so many years back that I'm actually very, very angry at other white nationalists that won't admit what is plain to the rest of us. But enough about that. I've gone on long enough. Since I don't have any more time this week, I do apologize for the short broadcast. As I mentioned, there are a couple things I didn't get to. First is why I call the Founding Fathers the Founding Felons on occasion. Now, that's an interesting historical and political lesson that we all need to internalize, but I can't do that justice today. Another thing I couldn't get to today was a very interesting criticism about the oddity of the party and our approach to white nationalism. Now, normally I ignore non-criticisms like that, because again, there was nothing specific named and no indication that we actually needed to do a particular thing different, but my gut told me to sit with that for a bit because there was something to it, and actually, I'd like to have a long conversation about it because, as it turns out, it's true, we're very odd compared to the rest of white nationalism, and I'd like to tell you all why when I have the time to do so. Like I said at the beginning of today's episode, this one's going to be short. That's all the show we've got for today. Radio Free Northwest is produced by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington 98310, or you can visit the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next time, comrades, freedom. Death, thank God, it still is beating.